Welcome to The Treasure Hunt, my personal attempt to share my musical curiosity with you. My name is Bas Wiegers, and I'm a conductor. As I'm recording this episode, it is a week ago that I conducted three pieces, Scar, Skin, and Skull, by Rebecca Saunders with Ensemble Moderne and the soprano Juliet Fraser at the Achtbrücken Festival in Cologne, Germany. The pieces Scar and Skin were older, but Skull was a world premiere. The rehearsal days in Frankfurt were so packed that Rebecca and I didn't manage to record material for a podcast, so we agreed to do it later on Zoom. When we make the Zoom call, she's enjoying some holiday time in Portugal, and I'm enjoying some days at home in Amsterdam. We speak about her particular way of working very closely with musicians to find special sounds and inspirations, and the way these sounds and inspirations make it into her music. Then we speak about how she constructs her music, composes it, writes it down, and about the next stage, the rehearsal process. We get to touch on the performative aspect too, the difference between live and recorded experiences. And before I release her again to enjoy the sun at the Portuguese beach, I briefly ask her about her extra musical inspirations. We enter the conversation after a bit of chit-chat about how good it is to take some time off, and I ask her what she will be working on when she gets back home to Berlin.
What are you working on now, actually, when you come back?
Opera.
Yay! When's the premiere?
June 25.
Okay. And until then, only that?
Well.
Yeah. That'd be boring, right?
There's a little chamber piece I wanted to write for MUFA since like 2 years, which is just pianissimo, like 11 minutes, taking a very quiet percussion solo on the timpani, just with like tiny string fragments, which are partially improvised according to a very stringent, reduced palette of sound. I will work with them in a kind of impro session for 3 hours. And we have a couple of three rehearsals also to do that and develop a notation for that. And after the premiere, I'll write it down. So that's one thing.
Can we take this as the starting point for our podcast? This is a piece that you will develop with Musikfabrik. And one of the questions I wanted to start with was how do you get your material? Your sounds are so incredibly specific. How do you develop them? Is that a way to start? Yeah, it could be a way to start the podcast.
That's good. Well, this specific piece is called All That Dust. And it's based on, let's put it like this. Over the years, up until basically before the lockdown, I had been working with Musikfabrik really pretty much nonstop for 20 years. And every now and then I would have pretty intense sessions. And I had one intense session actually with all of the string players. I asked if I could work with all of the string players when I was preparing Yes in 2017.
Right. Yes is the big piece that you wrote for voice and ensemble and big ensemble and solo flute actually also.
Oh, well, solo everything, to be honest.
True, but the flute is very...
So that's for 20 musicians and soprano, and it's a spatial and musical polyphony, which means that I wrote 28 modules, which are spread out in space, and those modules are basically separate pieces. I call them modules because of the way in which the form is constructed. So I have like a timeline, and all of these 28 pieces are juxtaposed and played at different times on the timeline, some of them simultaneously, a lot of them simultaneously. And all of the modules are placed in different places in space, and the musicians swap positions depending on which module they're playing. And for this piece, I generated an enormous amount of new material. And to do that, I met with a large number of musicians in different combinations. For example, I met with the double wind, double reed instruments, the bassoon, and the oboe and explore different kind of air-like sounds, which match sounds I'd been exploring on the trumpet with Marco Blau, the trumpeter there. Or I met with all of the string players and asked and developed with them a very specific kinds of sounds. On the one hand, very, very loud sounds, played right at the top of the lower string of the fourth or the fifth string, very distorted with very clear rhythmic patterns. And I just wanted to see what kind of, how it works physically, how it works acoustically, what the technical limits are, and what the expressive possibilities of this sound were. And that became module 25, for example, in, yes. I also explored with them very fragile sort of molto vibrato sounds going woo, 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 up and down the strings, or double trill harmonics going, but with regular rhythms, developing a sound which I'd used many years ago, like since about 2011. And specifically, this kind of vibrato sound, this sound, which I explored in Skull that you premiered so wonderfully last Monday, just a week ago. this specific sound I had developed with Music Fabric many years ago.
So this is me again from Amsterdam. I forgot to mention that Rebecca had quite a nasty cold, so she sounds a bit more rough than she normally does. Anyway, let's listen to some moments from the piece Yes that she mentioned. Ensemble Musikfabrik is playing, Enno Poppe is conducting, Juliet Fraser is the soprano. I will play some other fragments later of this piece as well.
And I decided this would be the opportunity to combine it with the percussion solo. This percussion solo I developed for two different percussionists, Christian Dierstein and Dirk Rotbrust from Music Fabrik. And Christian Dierstein is the percussionist from Recherche. So I'd worked with these two different percussionists for many years on and off. And percussion is one of those, well, it's not an instrument, one of those fields of acoustic research that is incredibly interesting. When I started off with it 30 years ago, I found it very, very hard to write for percussion because what you hear in the audience is so different from what you actually hear when you're next to a percussion instrument and exploring it, going, oh, that's so amazing, that's such a cool sound. And you actually realize once the sound is projected into a listening space or into a concert hall or even into an industrial space, it sounds completely different. And it took me a long time to learn how to notate that and how to work for it. But these two percussionists I worked very closely with over many years and developed lots of wonderful sounds and even developed different kinds of instruments. And then one day I decided to write a double concerto for both of them called Void and pooled these sounds together, the sounds I developed for Dirk and the sounds I developed for Christian, and partially swapped the sounds so that Christian was playing Dirk's sounds and Dirk was playing Christian's sound.
They got infected.
Yeah, they infected them with each other, yes. And after this, they both said, you've really got to write a solo. And I was like, no, I can never do that. It's far too difficult. And eventually I did. I wrote a solo, but for both of them. so that each one was able to do the premiere of the solo, but could tailor it to their own instruments, their own interpretation, their own needs, their own performance situation. So I created a very, very flexible piece, which was made of 7 different modules, which could be...
It is the same piece, but they could do it in different ways.
Yes, they could do it in a different order and have different points of reference, different places where they can overlap, etc. So that was a wonderful challenge, formally very difficult, and compositionally really stretched my brain. New synapses were like kind of building all over the place. The 7th module of this is called M7 of Dust. It's very, very quiet, and it's just played with grasses and little objects and stones and regular pulse sounds on a timpani, which projects these very quiet sounds. It can also be amplified. And this specific M7, I used also in another piece, which is a dance piece called Howl, which I developed for Ensemble Moderne. And there I saw that combining this with these string sounds that originally developed for Musikfabrik was a really, really interesting mixed palette. And I realized that I should actually finish this project I'd begun with Musikfabrik now that I'd heard these sounds together, and stick this stuff together and develop a form in which these sounds could coexist and be explored simultaneously. So I'm going to be developing a quasi-improvisational piece, where the palette's already completely set and the form is pretty much dictated by this original percussion module from the percussion solo Dust, and to which I will add another layer of the string players who then will improvise together with the percussionist. And that's something which very much sums up one of my most favorite ways of working. Very specific sounds, developing very reduced palettes of sound, which I explore together with the musicians, finding out what are the limits, what are the acoustic properties, what are the ways in which I should notate it, so I can really develop something very special for them.
Here is some of the magical stuff Dirk Rotbrust is doing in the piece Dust. There is a video on YouTube as well if you want to enjoy watching him producing these magical sounds. Does that mean that your music generates from an interest of specific sounds first, and then you start to build a form around it or with it? Or do you really make first the sort of building stones, like the sort of toolbox, and then you start creating or start shaping in your mind a sort of bigger image?
It depends, because it's not always like that. And also there are several processes, I think, that run simultaneously. There are also conceptual questions, you know, like what would happen if kind of thing, you know. For example, the piece Skull, which I wrote for Ensemble Moderne, which you conducted, that was very much a big conceptual question mark was, how do I write a third part to 3 individual pieces? How do I write that number 3 so that the form of all of those 3 pieces actually add up? How do I answer those first 2 pieces? What could happen out of that? How does that piece end, which is different from the way the other 2 end? What points of reference do I take from the first 2 pieces? How noticeable should they be? What are the audio points of reference? What instruments can I take in the percussion? What can I leave? What has to stay the same? What can be different? What kind of instrumentation would set off completely new colors, but still relate back to the original? What kind of form could I develop? So that's a big conceptual level which runs simultaneously to collecting sounds and defining these narrow palettes.
And then that sort of narrows out into a music, or you start somewhere, or do you really have to have sort of the complete image finished in your, like an overall image finished in your brain before you can start writing?
Oh, I do not have an overall image. If I did that, I wouldn't write in the first place. It's all about seeking and looking, exploring, and forming, creating the contours and the gestures of something that doesn't exist yet. You're creating something which doesn't exist yet, and that's so exciting. And if I knew what I wanted to make, then I wouldn't need to write it in the first place. It's about exploring material. I mean, definitely on a more specific compositional level, exploring these fragments of sounds, developing them, pushing them, pulling them, playing around with different kinds of density and stretching them over time, whether they form a kind of relief, a background to a foreground, whether in the foreground or the background, whether these fragments become melodic or harmonic or just appear as a kind of mini episode. These little fragments of sound define pretty much how the form will then develop. It's through exploring the music, the sounds themselves, that a form then develops. It's very much intrinsic to the sound itself.
And then you get to the stage where you come to Frankfurt and we have a first rehearsal. I mean, first rehearsal, you weren't there, but you came for the second rehearsal. And then what happens in a composer's brain? I'm always so curious to, you must be sort of half terrified and half sort of excited to hear this first rehearsal. What kind of a rehearsal is that for you?
It's super exciting, and it's important to be prepared, because there are things which might be a little bit open, you know, for the contraforte, for example,
which is the double bass, like the contrabassoon, but a different version of the contrabassoon, right? For people who don't
know. Yeah, a more flexible, modern alternative to the contrabassoon. It's much more flexible and has an extremely differentiated dynamic range and tonal range.
Most ensembles actually have that instrument now. The symphony orchestra.
A lot of orchestras too.
Oh yeah, more and more.
Mm. Cool.
Yeah. But then you come to the rehearsal and you say you want to be prepared.
Because I have to know, if I haven't written for the contraforte before, and I had worked with Johannes Schwarz, the bassoon player, from Ensemble Modern, and I explored certain sounds, and then I had several questions and regarding notation and running one sound after another, how much time do you need in between, and what is the technical limit of this sound, and what note could I start on to build up this interesting multiphonic, and what note can I end on, and things like that. There will nevertheless, if you understand, okay, let's go back one step. If you understand, like, really, really well how a certain fragment of sound functions, how it's made on the instrument, how loud it can be, how quiet it can be, what the starting note is, and how it develops, That's one thing. But if you put it within an ensemble context, the way in which it functions, what the acoustic impact is, what happens to the density of it is always completely surprising because I've never worked with this sound before. So I can predict, I can hear it in my head, but is it correct? And if it isn't, I have to be prepared. Okay, so what does this mean? Do I have an alternative modiphonic I might want to use? Do I offer them the use of using a bisipiando, like a same note trill or a flutterton, to balance the multiphonic, to give it, to make it more smooth or to make it develop more gradually? Or I just have to be prepared for these new sounds to provide alternatives and then to work constructively with the musicians. They say, well, it's not working in this context. Say, okay, that's great that you tell me that. Thank you. Let's do A, B, and C and see if that fits better in this context. That's what I mean about being prepared.
It was interesting.
Or if, for example, I have a new percussion instrument and they have a specific beater I want. Then I can, then they can write to me and say, we don't have this beater. What exactly sound is what the sound you want? And Rainer Römer wrote to me from Ensemble Day, said, we don't have this certain kind of very thin, long thunder sheet. What's exactly the sound that you need? And I described the shimmering, gentle overtones I wanted, and he got the right beaters and brought an alternative with him just in case it didn't work. That's what I mean about being prepared. Mm. And that's super fun because it means that you're really involved in the whole process right up to the end. And you feel as if you're constructively working with the musician too, because everyone really wants to make it work.
Yeah. It was a nice process for me also to be part of, because I, of course, I did the first rehearsal without you. And then, you know, you already get an idea of what the piece could be, and you sort of solve a few sort of basic, more basic questions, or this probably has to blend, or this probably has to be juxtaposed, or this probably has to be a crossfade of two different sounds, blah, blah, blah. So this is sort of a basic entrance of what it, how it could work, but then once you're there, and then of course you get also the people who said, yes, we worked on these sounds, but now she put them all behind each other, and now of course I can't manage or whatever, or I need time to do this anyway. So this is sort of the starting point. But then once you were there and we started working on it sort of together, and also indeed developing some of the sounds that we weren't so sure worked so well, then it really got into a sort of very personal shape, and a tool that you could start to play with, because you start understanding the meaning. I mean, meaning is a difficult word, but anyway, you start understanding what it can be, and not understanding is what Oetfersch always says: you don't have to play what is written; you have to understand what is written. And yes. And this is so if this multiphonic doesn't work, but we understand, or it doesn't work in this specific case, but we understand why it's there, then we can offer you maybe another, or you can offer us maybe another option that works better. And
it's so important as a composer to think of that, you know, because like if you've got this really special multiphonic and it's being played together with three other multiphonics from the other instruments and it's pianissimo, but the player with it on its own, they can play it, but within context, they can't pitch it. Or for the first couple of times, they can't pitch it. First, at the beginning, they say, es geht nicht, it's not possible. But actually, once they've got used to it and know what the other musicians are doing, then it does work, you know, or the other way around, you know, they actually cannot work within that context. Maybe there's some kind of weird beating, so it's not actually functioning, something I hadn't thought of. And to be flexible and actually find an alternative is super important.
Can I move to another point that I'm always really interested in within your music, which is how time moves? Because this, so far we've been speaking about, you know, the quality of sounds or the different sounds, but you're also very specific in the shaping of time. You have often very slow
metronome marks, like tempo 42, which is extremely slow to conduct. And then
36.
I know 36 is the worst. Yeah, I know. 36 is basically physically impossible. And then you have to start subdividing, but then it gives another feeling. And it's, and then you go from 42 to 46, and it's like, and you even write moving on. So like più allegretto, or like faster. But the, of course, the difference is very small. How do you imagine this behind your desk, in a music that even sometimes doesn't even have a clear pulse? How do you measure the sequence of events in time?
I hear it.
Hmm.
You know, the beginning of the piece Scar, the first bar, I think you're in 36 or 42?
Yeah. 36. No, it's 1336.
And the conductor just beats a 4/4 bar. That, I think that's just so magic. I love that. And it's so hard, but it is possible. I remember last time I was here in Porto, sitting between Sylvain Cambrelin and Enno Popper, and both of them trying to do a 30, well, not trying, but doing a 36 together at the restaurant. Such a cool nerd moment. That was so fun. And it was so beautiful. And just, I love that. It's just suddenly like you're in the audience and you see the conductor lowering his hand with the patience and clarity and simplicity. I'm going to the right now. Okay, and now I'm going up. It's just something so beautiful about that. The conductor is also, of course, a musician, is also one of the musicians performing on the stage. The audience, just to be so aware of that moment, how time just slows down, and how just in that empty bar you move into a completely different zone. I didn't think about it so obviously, but now, and once the piece was actually first performed back in whenever that was, 19 or something, I was aware of what I was doing. It's just to imagine the conductor's hand or arm moving through space, slowing down time, making the listener, helping the listener to just move into a different time zone. I think that's a good example of that working.
This is
another way. Yeah.
This is, no, it's a nice example also of what I every time again state to people who have a hard time getting into new music or newer music. This is a very good example of why one shouldn't just listen to this at home on the, because then you have no idea what happens in that first bar, because then you just hear the entrance of a percussion instrument on the fourth beat, but you have no idea it's the fourth beat. Yeah. And actually, when you've had this whole introduction of a conductor doing three beats in 36, which is basically almost 6 seconds, it's 5 seconds, I think, already theater or concentration or whatever it is, before you even hear a sound that is not actually even there, because it starts so soft that you might actually miss it when you don't see it. So this is definitely a reason to listen to this music live and it's see this music happening also.
I think the thing is what you said, it's like this moment of theater. What sitting in the audience together with many other people is such a special shared community experience in a way, isn't it? This shared listening experience, and the ensemble are on the stage and there's complete silence, and you see the conductor begin to do something, and then after, like you say, 5 or 6 seconds, there's just a on the percussion at the back.
Yeah,
you
nothing.
Your ears are wide open.
Yeah,
you are
yeah.
Watching. You are expectant. You are open. You are transparent. And and it can begin. It's a nice moment. And that's, of course, the live listening experience has so many other dimensions to offer than just listening to a recording in your computer, you know, which is such a different experience. And I think it's also so important to remember that if you're listening to a music you've never heard before, there's one thing listening to a Bach partita on a CD, where you can almost relate that to a previous experience of listening to Bach. You have a whole nother narrative going on. You also have your past, you have associations with it, you might have a concert performance in your mind, whereas a new piece of music requires a completely different listening technique in a way. You have to be so open and tolerant and welcoming to something which you have no idea what is going to happen. That's so exciting. But that requires from one a tolerance and an openness and being prepared to engage with something unknown. And that's so exciting. And that's so important to be in that situation sometimes.
Let's say at the beginning of Scar, even though you won't see anybody wave this wonderful empty 4-4 bar at the beginning, it's very soft, as we discussed.
You speak now about your audience or an audience, or do you also imagine an audience when you write, or is this something that is more sort of in the back of your head?
I don't think there is in that respect like an audience, you know. I am also the audience, you know. I am creating music which will also be, once I finish the piece and maybe heard it once or something, I then am also a listener, you know. And you are a listener conducting that piece. The musicians are also a listener. We're all listeners, because the wonderful thing about the whole creative process of writing a piece, performing a piece, and listening to a piece, which is also a creative act, by the way, is that it's all about listening. So I don't think one can actually say the audience. I think that's actually almost a mistake to do that, actually, to give them as a kind of fixed, anonymous identity. We are all listeners, I think.
Mm. I like that. You spoke, or we spoke about theater, or the theatricality of something. Now, of course, also in this concert that we just did with the piece Scar and the piece Skin and the piece Skull, the second piece is a piece for voice and ensemble, of which you've written a couple. How did you work on that? Because it's a very different thing to have spoken text or to have text present, because text has definitely directly meaning. I mean,
it was important for me to find a way to write for text, because for many years I found it super hard to imagine giving a kind of to it's hard. I think what's always used to, or has always fascinated me so much and still does in music, is that it implies things, but it doesn't tell you how things are. Yeah, it opens up spaces and creates a possibility to feel and think something, but it doesn't tell you what to think and feel. It's so subjective. And the abstraction of this particular art form is wonderful. Abstraction doesn't mean it's cerebral and removed. It means it gives us an enormous subjectivity when we listen to music, that our subjectivity really plays an enormous role in the listening experience. So when I found that the idea of writing for voice so scary for quite a few decades, because I didn't want to say the piece is about this. I didn't want a text to dictate to me and to the musicians and to the listener what the piece is about. I didn't want semantics. I didn't want a narrative, and I didn't want a story. I didn't want to dictate. I still wanted just to open up a space. And then I found a way gradually over the years to approach that. And I was working with Juliet Fraser, the soprano, who's also singing in the concert, and with for whom I wrote the piece, and explored different ways of suppressing meaning and implying ideas and feelings and states of being and different kinds of narratives, but without actually having clear semantics. That was really important for me, and it was quite a long process to find a way through. Since then, it's been so liberating to do that, that I actually, after writing Skin, I really missed the voice. I was quite lost without it.
And the text that you use, for example, in Skin, how do you find them?
I developed it myself, apart from one quotation from the very end of Molly Bloom's monologue in Ulysses from James Joyce. So it's the last section of that I actually have as what I call the sixth, I think, text image. I have like several images which are inserted during the form where the soprano recites, but each time is constricted slightly how she recites. So the meaning is partially suppressed or wholly suppressed, but certain words and certain phrases reoccur. And this text was partly made out of very dense poems I had written as program text for different pieces, definitions of very specific words with an enormous spectrum of different meanings. For example, the word dust or still or stir or murmurs or very Beckettian words. Very strongly, I think this text is influenced by my fascination with Beckett and having absorbed so many of his later prose works. And also the text is full of instructions to what I call, well, I suppose one could call them instructions to the musician, like moving on or things like that. Little quotations in that respect. So I wrote the text simultaneously with writing the music, and it isn't a text which is extra, which needs to be understood. I really see it as a musical line, which is partly hidden within the context of the ensemble writing, and then suddenly it comes to the foreground and can almost be understood, but then disappears. It's the idea of a monologue, an internal monologue, which every now and again becomes external, giving us a glimpse of the protagonist beneath the surface, who then again disappears, which is very much how we are.
I cannot do a podcast with Rebecca Saunders without playing a bit from Skin, the piece I conducted the most, always with the magnificent soprano Juliet Fraser on my side.
It's lovely to hear you speak about working with people so closely, because it's really connected to how in the very old days people would write for soloists or for people they really know, and then you develop You know, Mozart wrote this aria for somebody.
Of course.
Was, you know, there happened to be somebody who could sing the Queen of the Night. And so he wrote the Queen of the Night. And now it's the problem of all the people who need to sing that. But it was developed for somebody specific.
Of course.
And I love the fact that you really do the same. So you write for Noah and you write for Juliet. And then, of course, later, other people can do this as well, or they can make it their own, because it sort of develops the technique further. But it's lovely that this really comes from a super close collaboration, like whatever the Bach, no, so Brahms wrote the violin concerto together with Joseph Joachim. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't have, and actually the whole violin technique would have been different, because Joachim, you know, he made this happen. And it's lovely to see that this is really also part of our contemporary practice, actually.
Well, that's why I wrote Skull, to be honest. I mean, working with Sava, the trumpet player from Ensemble Moderne.
This is Sava Stoyanov, the trumpet player from Ensemble Moderne, in a beautiful little YouTube video he made during the corona lockdown.
I mean, working with Sava, the trumpet player of Ensemble Moderne, was so decisive. I mean, I worked with all most of the brass and the wind players, and the piece really focuses in on those instruments more so than I've ever done before. And because I really wanted to investigate the lyrical quality of those instruments. And I've worked a hell of a lot with the trumpet over decades now, and specifically with Marco Blau, but also with Bill Foreman and other trumpet players. But working with Sava was so interesting because he has such a different sound and comes from such a different tradition. When he plays, like when he feels really at home on the instrument, he's just warming the instrument up. He sort of drops the trumpet slightly and gives it a totally beautiful airy quality. And he improvised sort of Bulgarian fragments of melody for me, which are basically the melodic fragments at the beginning of Skull or throughout the whole of Skull.
Right.
And I developed this on and on and on. And actually the piece started as a very, very long trumpet melody, which modulates gradually and explores different sounds using the cut mute, which is very specific to this sound, either open or closed. And he can play so quietly on this instrument down at the bottom of the trumpet. So I developed a completely different color on the instrument to what I've done before. And that was for me so exciting, because trumpet is one of those instruments I know best in a way. And I found something so new. And it was thanks to Sava and these Bulgarian melodies that the piece actually took on this lyrical quality that it has. So these quarter toned sort of half tone and quarter tone glissandis going down and up were very much about his melody, his style of playing, and the sounds which are closest to his heart in a way. So that's how the piece actually developed through this. And then I gradually orchestrated that melody. First of all, it was a duo between the viola and the trumpet, and the saxophone and came in on this, and gradually it became the sort of complex polyphonic web of melodies that it is now.
Let's do a last question, which is maybe extra musical, or I'm just always interested in how what other things inspire you in art, or in, I mean, if you want to be inspired, what are your sources? Where do you look for?
Everything.
Food.
I mean, yeah, food. I love cooking. I love food. Food's a strange thing. Cooking really great things is deeply satisfying because it doesn't take 6 months to get the dish on the table, and also, yeah, it's so, and you can immediately see and sense the pleasure of the participants of the meal. You know, that's kind of cool. So that's different. But no, I would, I every I mean, I'm in Porto now, and I asked for a room at the back, and I'm looking out at the sea, and just to sit here and look at the sea is just super, super, super inspirational. Anything, everything, sounds, everything. I need to, it's important for me to have a lot of time alone, so that I can filter everything I have experienced and thinking and the sounds and the pictures and the images and the feelings and everything. I need time to filter things, I think. I do get overwhelmed sometimes because I kind of see and hear and feel and smell everything. You know, going to a museum, I don't need to look at every picture. I can just focus in on two or three, and I will stay a long time in front of one or two of those, and that's enough for me. Any other artistic mediums are always super inspiring because we all deal with the same contemporary issues in very different ways. Some severely abstracted, some directly speaking out, defining those present contemporary issues. But in all different art mediums, one goes about it in very different ways. So it is fascinating to pick up on those threads, to see different perspectives and different ways of expressing and exploring certain issues in all mediums. But I mean, sometimes it's just quite shocking, the similarities of what I'm thinking about, and then I'll just see it in a poem or even in a dictionary definition, or looking at a piece of art, and I'll see how, I don't know, three wavering forms are juxtaposed, and I can immediately apply that to a formal question I've been grappling with in my mind or something. And I absorb a lot of literature, and sometimes I'll just come across one sentence totally taken out of context, and that will provide the backbone of a thought which is actually running through a whole piece. But it's not one to one, and it would be very silly to then actually sort of describe that or analyze that, because at the end of the day, I'm not an intellectual. You know, I don't have one of those extraordinary classical educations. You know, I'm a thinking, feeling musician more than anything else.
I think we covered quite a bit of beautiful ground. So
Great.
maybe I should leave you to the beautiful, wonderful sun in Porto. Thank you very much, Rebecca.
Thank you, Bev.
Thank you for listening to The Treasure Hunt. I will put links to the pieces in the show notes. If there are subjects you would like me to speak about in this podcast, contact me through my website. Please follow this podcast on your favorite platform and stay tuned for the next episode.